Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Suicide bomber kills 33 in Yemen, and Palestinians look to ICC after failed UN statehood bid. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. A suicide bomber has attacked a gathering of Shiite Houthi rebels in central Yemen, killing at least 33 people. The blast happened Wednesday as people were celebrating the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad at a cultural center in the city of Ibb. The provincial governor was among those wounded in the attack. Residents and security forces also reported a second bomb in the area. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Palestinian leaders say they will look to join the International Criminal Court to pursue action against Israel a day after their bid for statehood failed in the United Nations Security Council. Palestinian representative to the UN, Riyad Mansour, said the Palestinian people can no longer wait. He said officials will meet Wednesday to discuss ICC membership as an avenue to bring charges of possible war crimes against Israel. Late Tuesday, the 15-member UN Security Council voted against a draft resolution that demanded Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, explained the no vote.
We voted against this resolution not because we are indifferent to the daily hardships or the security threats endured by Palestinians and Israelis, but because we know that those hardships will not cease and those threats will not subside until the parties reach a comprehensive settlement achieved through negotiations.
Riyad Mansour, the Palestinian representative at the United Nations, criticized the council, saying it is not fulfilling its responsibilities. This is VOA News. The first two bodies recovered from the crash site of an Air Asia flight have arrived in the city of Surabaya, where Indonesian forensic experts will identify the remains. Emergency teams have found seven bodies in the Java Sea since spotting wreckage Tuesday, 2 days after Flight 8501, carrying 162 people, disappeared en route from Surabaya to Singapore. Search and rescue agency officials said waves of up to 3 meters strong winds, and heavy rain are preventing a full air search effort at the crash site near the island of Borneo. Officials said sonar images suggest a portion of the plane is lying upside down on the bottom of the sea in an area 30 to 50 meters deep. Reuters news agency says 4 migrants were found dead aboard a cargo ship left adrift in the Adriatic Sea with at least 900 people on board. The Moldovan-flagged Blue Sky M arrived at the southern Italian port of Gallipoli, met by Italian Red Cross workers and other emergency personnel. The relief agency says most of the migrants are Syrian refugees. The Italian Navy took over the ship late Tuesday after discovering the crew had abandoned the vessel and rigged the engine to crash into the coast. The ship was first spotted earlier in the day near the Greek island of Corfu after someone on board sent out a distress call. Greece's parliament has been formally dissolved ahead of a general election that could end an era of austerity that has led to political and social upheaval. Parliament dissolved Wednesday after rejecting Prime Minister Antonis Samaras's choice for a new president and announced that elections would be held on January 25th. Baji Kaid Essebsi has been sworn in as Tunisia's new president, becoming the country's first freely elected leader since it gained independence from France in 1956. Mr. Essebsi took the oath of office Wednesday at a ceremony in the parliament where his party won the most seats in an October election. The 88-year-old president won a runoff election this month, defeating incumbent Moncef Marzouki, who had served as Tunisia's interim president since 2011. And officials in Gambia say President Yahya Jammeh has returned to the country a day after an apparent coup attempt. The officials said Mr. Jammeh arrived back in Banjul on Wednesday. Security forces locked down the city and patrolled the streets after clashes early Tuesday at the presidential palace. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says the number of new confirmed Ebola cases in Liberia is declining. Liberians were once at the epicenter of this regional epidemic, but several parts of the country have now gone weeks without reporting any new cases. Some medical staff are returning to work amid renewed vigilance. It's an important sign of progress.
That's VOA's Anne Look reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Gambia president returned to the presidential palace following his government's denial of reports of a coup attempt yesterday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Gambia's president Yahya Jammeh returned to the presidential palace following his government's denial of reports of a coup attempt yesterday. He has been on a personal visit to Dubai. The British news agency Reuters reports that upon his arrival at the presidential palace, Mr. Jammeh was shown the bodies of those who had attacked the palace and were repelled by security forces. A military officer said the government troops had killed three suspects, including an army deserter. They were unconfirmed reports that one of the dead is a former head of the presidential guard, Lamine Sana. Shops have reopened since the capital shut down earlier in the week. Military forces are still guarding the Denton Bridge that provides the only entry to the country's island capital. Jammeh has survived several coup attempts. The 49-year-old leader seized power in a 1994 coup. The U.S. State Department strongly urged that the nation refrain from violence and any extra constitutional means of seizing power. Jammeh's strong-arm rule has been harshly criticized by many African countries and non-African countries. The European Union withdrew millions of dollars in aid from the former British colony when Jammeh signed a law condemning homosexuals to life in prison. In 2012, he was criticized for executing nine people being held in prison without trial.
Egyptian military officials say they have killed 13 terrorists and arrested more than 300 suspects in 4 days of raids on hotbeds in the Sinai Peninsula. A military spokesman said they destroyed more than 100 terrorist headquarters in the raids. He gave no military casualty figures. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi declared a state of emergency in the Sinai 3 months ago. Ansar Bet al-Maqdis and other militants in the Sinai have targeted government forces since Mr. Sisi ousted and arrested former President Mohamed Morsi and began a crackdown on members of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
The year-long conflict in South Sudan has taken a heavy toll on the population through malnutrition, death, and displacement. But the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says millions of cattle have also been displaced, raising concerns over disease outbreaks and tensions between pastoral groups. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Sue Lautzi says the FAO is quite concerned, not only about the livestock, but the millions of people who rely on the animals for their livelihoods. Lautzi is the UN agency's representative to South Sudan. From Juba, she spoke to VOA about the crisis just over a year since the conflict began.
When people ran, they also ran with their cattle, and they did everything they could to try and find a place to survive a tremendous amount of violence. And the running has gone on all year, both for the people and for the cattle.
As a result of the conflict, she says, the normal patterns of cattle migration were disrupted.
When the rains end, the pastoralists will move their cattle and their goats and their sheep towards the water sources where there's good grass and water to be had. And then when the rains come back, they can disperse across a wide part of this country to, again, be in pursuit of good pastures. So what we have now, though, is people just going anywhere with their livestock, including into areas where there are people farming. And so we have conflicts between the livestock owners and the farmers who don't want the cows to come in and eat the sorghum, which is understandable.
She says the situation could destabilize some communities that have so far been able to refrain from violence. However, she says, in some parts of Sudan, cattle-related violence has reached unprecedented levels. One such area is Lakes State.
The kind of violence that we're seeing there normally would be contained by the security forces if this was a normal year, because there are a lot of tensions. There's a lot of competition for resources between groups as they move towards pastures, towards water, towards even areas where they need to do salt licks for the livestock. Many times it's the governors of the states that are holding peace conferences. But because so much of the political and security apparatus is engaged in a different problem, the problem of the ongoing fight, that we see these types of fights erupt without any control on them.
Following the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005, herders were able to move their cattle to places they had not been before. That migration introduced livestock diseases, such as East Coast fever, to new areas. It's a tick-borne disease that can quickly kill young cattle.
We're now seeing, as a result of this crisis, unprecedented expansion of diseases like East Coast fever. In addition, we're seeing some of the diseases that come when livestock can't move normally, particularly when they get stuck in waterlogged areas. We begin to see issues of rot, foot rot. We begin to see issues of liver fluke that the livestock owners would normally know how to avoid if they could move properly. So the livestock teams for FAO, our partners, the Red Cross, government, have been super busy, and I don't think we're actually able to keep pace just yet.
The cattle displacement and the disease risk it poses also is a threat to South Sudan's food security.
Here in South Sudan, the livestock generally are not slaughtered for meat unless it's for maybe a big wedding or in case of really dire emergencies, which unfortunately we have right now. Most of the time, it's the milk products from the livestock. When the cattle herds are not near families because they're having to move away, when the livestock are sick and they're not producing as much milk, then we start to see a real impact on the nutritional status of pregnant and lactating women, of young children, of youth, you know, boys and girls of school age.
The ability to farm in South Sudan has also been restricted or curtailed in areas of conflict. The FAO representative says there is a solution to the problems.
South Sudan needs peace. There is no greater contribution to the health and welfare, the prevention of a deteriorating food security crisis. There's nothing more important than peace.
Nevertheless, Lautsi says the FAO and its partners are preparing to expand operations. She says the agency is asking for about $90 million. She says the donors have been generous. And in 2014, FAO programs reached nearly 3 million people. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Ruhi, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh returned to the presidential palace following his government's denial of reports of a coup attempt yesterday. And Egyptian military officials say they have killed 13 terrorists and arrested more than 300 suspects in 4 days of raids. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Ebola screening procedures at London's Heathrow Airport are being criticized after a nurse from Glasgow returning to London from working in Sierra Leone developed a fever and was diagnosed with the virus the next day. Nurse Pauline Cafferkey is now in isolation and treatment at Royal Free Hospital in London. She is the first person to be diagnosed with the virus in the UK. A doctor who flew back from Sierra Leone with Cafferkey said there were too few staff at Heathrow and the medical workers were not segregated from other passengers. Chief Medical Officer Sally Davies said the process does seem to have not been as good as we all wanted to see, she says. However, she said Cafferkey had not shown symptoms and posed little risk to fellow passengers.
The World Health Organization says the number of new confirmed Ebola cases in Liberia is declining. Liberians were once at the epicenter of this regional epidemic, but several parts of the country have now gone weeks without reporting any new cases. Some medical staff are returning to work amid renewed vigilance. It's an important sign of progress. VOA's Anne Look has the story, with reporting in Monrovia by Prince Collins.
The Dolo Town Health Center, just outside the Liberian capital, is open. Mothers bring their children for vaccinations against polio and measles. People come in for tuberculosis treatment and HIV counseling. A midwife here says she delivered 10 babies since they reopened a month ago. The sheer normalcy of it all has the feel of the remarkable. Liberia's health system collapsed in August as Ebola bore down on Monrovia. Dolo Town was one of two suburbs put under an abrupt quarantine. The quarantine was lifted 2 weeks later, but the community continued to battle Ebola. Locals say more than four dozen people are believed to have died here of the virus. Even now at year's end, a local task force watches for sporadic cases. This newly opened clinic is not taking any chances. They built a special waiting area in front. Midwife Kebe Carmo keeps a close watch.
Insert it on here, please. You know, we shouldn't set jam up, you know, beside one another. Because you don't know who is who. Ebola patient might be among us. We are protecting you and protecting ourselves.
Staff wear gloves. They screen for Ebola symptoms like fever and send those patients to a larger care center nearby. The clinic has a stock of PPEs just in case. That's the full-body protective gear staff should wear if they see a suspected Ebola case. Physician's assistant McFarlane Kurkula says getting those PPEs persuaded most of the nurses to return.
That's why we are having the courage to work right now.
As Ebola surged in Liberia in mid-2014, many medical staff didn't even have gloves. More and more of them were getting sick. Health workers went on strike. Most clinics shut down. People were afraid to go to the clinics still open. It was tragedy multiplied. The government said people would die of treatable, preventable causes. Childbirth complications, malaria, respiratory illness, high blood pressure. International Ebola response ramped up in Liberia in October. At year's end, the epidemic is not over. But the worst of it may be. A few big hospitals have reopened. Small community clinics like this one are edging open their doors.
Yeah, morning. I know everybody has washed their hands before. If you didn't wash your hands, then you need to do that, please. Because if you don't do it, we don't allow you to even go inside that, you know.
Every morning, the Dolo Town Health Center gives out tickets. Staff triage cases, giving priority to the most critical. This used to be a 24-hour clinic, but now they see just 25 people per day. It's a safety measure. Non-urgent cases are told to return the next day. Kukula is a strong believer in what he calls holistic care.
I want to say thank you for coming. We want to feel relaxed. Everybody here will get treatment before 1 o'clock.
Kukula says they will soon start the day's consultations. But first,
we ask one person to give us short sun so that we will start.
And with that, a new day begins. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
Researchers believe that bats are the source of the virus behind the current Ebola epidemic in West Africa, but a new study points to a different species than the fruit bats implicated in earlier outbreaks. Faith Lapidus reports.
The Ebola virus usually jumps from its animal host to humans through contaminated bushmeat. Hunters bring home an infected fruit bat or an ape or antelope that contracted the virus. While bats are unaffected carriers of Ebola, it is deadly for other forest dwellers. In earlier outbreaks, large mammals were also affected. But when researchers from Berlin's Robert Koch Institute arrived in Guinea in April to investigate the growing epidemic, they found no decline in the wildlife population. So they turned their attention to another source of transmission, theorizing that the virus was coming directly from its host, bats. Dr. Fabian Lindertz, who led the team, says they focused on hunters and their efforts to catch and kill fruit bats until they learned that the first victim of the current Ebola outbreak was a 2-year-old boy.
That changed a bit our point of view, and I thought we have to also look at children and their behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the breaking point, because the children don't hunt the fruit bats. But what they do in these villages, in general, they hunt the small insect bats with sticks under the roof and in trees, and wherever they find them, they will hunt them and kill them and roast them over the fire.
Through interviews in the boys' village of Meliandou, the researchers learned that local children often played in a large hollow tree that was home to a large colony of Angolan free-tailed bats. The presence of hundreds of the mouse-sized creatures presented the possibility of massive exposure to the virus. Writing in Embo Molecular Medicine, Lindert says the findings expand the range of possible reservoirs for Ebola.
What we want to say a little bit with this article is that since we don't know what is exactly the reservoir and what the virus does in the reservoir and how it's circulating and so on, we should keep an open view and also include in the investigations insectivorous bats and not only focus on fruit bats like most teams have done in the past.
Starting with a young boy in a small village in Guinea, Ebola has spread to more than a half dozen countries, infected more than 20,000 people, and killed more than 7,800. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, today is the last chance for more than 250,000 refugees from Zimbabwe to register for permits to legally remain in South Africa. The Home Affairs Department says about 190,000 have applied for the special permits as of yesterday. Another 55,000 are eligible to apply. Since 2009, refugees fleeing political and economic troubles in neighboring Zimbabwe have been allowed to stay in South Africa. The new permits will be issued in April of 2015 and are valid until 2017. Similar applications will be required of other Southern African Development Community nationals in the future.
Just a decade ago, South Africa was a grim place for AIDS sufferers and worse for pregnant women. They had no access to drugs that would prevent them from giving the life-threatening virus to their babies. That changed when a group of South African patients stepped forward and sued for access to cheaper drugs. VOA's Anita Powell spoke with one of those activists in Johannesburg.
Hazel Tau says she remembers the dark days of HIV in South Africa, the nation with the world's highest burden of the disease. But the 45-year-old is not talking about the now distant year of 1991 when she was first diagnosed with HIV. She is talking about her decision in 2002 to reveal her status to the entire country by suing in South African court for access to cheaper AIDS drugs, which were then behind a high wall of patent protection. At the time, she was working as an HIV counselor and spending more than one-fifth of her pay on medication. In winning that landmark case, she became the mother of a cause, and the results have been living and breathing HIV-free babies. Her fight to bring down drug prices also enabled widespread availability of preventative medicines for pregnant HIV-positive women. Today, transmission rates between mothers and children hover below 3% in South Africa. And for that, this World AIDS Day, more than two decades after her diagnosis, Tau says she is thankful that she and about 2.5 million South Africans have access to free AIDS medicine.
Things are much, much, much better. pregnant women access treatment to prevent their unborn baby. For people tested positive, treatment is accessible, and there are different regimens of treatment.
Doctors Without Borders head HIV-TB coordinator for Southern Africa, Eric Gomar, says much has changed since he arrived in South Africa in 1999.
While everybody speaks about reducing incidence, reducing new infection, it's extremely difficult to do with sexual transmission. But in this case, mother-to-child transmission, actually it's an easy-to-do intervention. When I arrived here, we had something like 22% transmission, meaning one mother upon five would give birth to an HIV-positive child. And it has been reduced now to 2.7% nationwide. So it's one-tenth of this. Still too many. It shouldn't exist anymore. That's something, it's an easy intervention to do, something that should be eradicated, like it has almost been eradicated in the Western world.
Dr. Gomar and Tao say the fight now is to extend antenatal treatment to all women in South Africa and bring the mother-to-child transmission rate down even further. Many women in poor and rural communities do not receive antiretroviral treatment in time to prevent their babies from contracting HIV. And so to this day, thousands of South Africans are born with this chronic disease. Tao says she would sue all over again. She says she has 24 compelling reasons to do so.
It's where now I'm an activist, and I'm a working class, and I'm a breadwinner. I've got a mother, I've got siblings, 23 siblings. I'm looking after them.
But her legal victory came too late for her. Tao never became a mother. Her husband packed up and left shortly after learning of her status, and her diagnosis came during the grim days when AIDS patients were advised to not procreate at all. But this World AIDS Day, millions of HIV-free babies in South Africa owe their health to the fruits of her labor. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhiv in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. Its symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain. Within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Gambia's President Yahya Jammeh returns to the presidential palace following his government's denial of reports of a coup attempt yesterday. And the year-long conflict in South Sudan has taken a heavy toll on the population through malnutrition, death, and displacement. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, a report by the World Meteorological Organization on the Earth's protective ozone layer. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday. Happy New Year, Kim. And happy New Year to all our Voice of America listeners.
Well, thank you, Sunny. I guess you might say your final sports report for 2014 packs some punch.
Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moweta. Happy New Year, Nnamdi.
And a happy Kwanzaa to you, Sunny.
Nnamdi, let's talk about 2014, the year in boxing. Your pick for fight of the year.
Well, my pick for fight of the year will be Nicholas Walters from Jamaica against Nonito Donaire, right here in my backyard at the Home Depot in Los Angeles. Nonito Donaire is from the Philippines, and he's destroyed all this super bantams and bantam was the man, all the hype. And he had this card from Jamaica by way of Panama, just came into L.A. and then knocked him out cold, and it was just quite a fight to watch. So I will go with Nicholas Walters from Jamaica against Nonito Donaire from Philippines.
Nnamdi, your choice of fighter of the year for 2014.
Well, it's a controversial call because I look at two different things, you know. Yeah, well, is this fighter a pull? Can he pull numbers? Can he put eyes on television? Can he put seats in the house? And the only fighter that can do that today is Money Mayweather. You can say all you want to say about the Money Man, that he's been hand-picking or cherry-picking, but he's the only fighter today that could do the pay-per-view numbers we talk about after the fight. So I will give it to him. And mind you, he did two fights in a year, which is rare.
Nnamdi, we'll talk more about Floyd Mayweather, but let's talk about African fighters and how they did in 2014. Your thoughts?
It was a bad year for African fighters in the U.S. because, you remember, this is the mecca of boxing in the USA. Take you back to the 80s, the 90s, Azuma Nelson doing his thing on television, Ike Bazooka Kwate, John the Beast Mugabe. We're all very happy. But today, what we see are fighters just coming in from Africa and getting knocked out on TV. And we see all our stars rebuilding. I'm talking about Sharif the Lion Bogare from Uganda rebuilding. And then...
That's what I'm lucky for. That's why the people call me. In Nigeria, people call me Playboy. But that was my whole name.
Yeah.
But when I travel overseas, I'm like, I'm a lucky boy.
Lucky boy in Hollywood.
Lucky boy in Australia, lucky boy in Hollywood.
Wally Amoto showed the Playboy rebuilding. Samuel Peters also rebuilding. So it's that rebuilding they're doing, and I would say it's not been a good one. But one bright spot is from South Africa. He is from KwaZulu-Natal. His name is Thembiso Mchunu. He's a cruiserweight. He's a North American Boxing Federation cruiserweight champion. And he's really done very well, and he's from KwaZulu, South Africa.
Nnamdi, you mentioned the Ugandan Lion, Sharif Bogare, rebuilding. Pretty good year overall for the Ugandan Lion. Do you see a title shot for him in 2015?
Definitely the title fight for the Lion, because one, he's what we call a television fighter. He brings eyeballs to television. The TV executives like him because he's a showman. He can fight. He only lost one fight. So see 2015 for him being a year he will strike and go for the title.
Nnamdi, what about the situation of the fight game in your homeland of Nigeria? Do you see it being resuscitated in 2015?
Big country, Nigeria, they've always been football crazy, from the minister to everybody to the president. It's all football, football, football. But forgetting that country is blessed with talent, you know. We see something new that just happened recently in Nigeria where television finally stepped in. You know, we have what's called GoTV, had their first show. And GoTV is a subsidiary of a Super Sport from South Africa. And if you look back at the boxing in South Africa, without Super Sport in South Africa, there will be no boxing. So we look for big things to happen in 2015 with television stepping in. And a couple of big boys are ready to make some big announcement in 2015. And I'm glad that I'll be part of this announcement. And hopefully, spring of 2015, something big will happen in Nigeria with boxing.
It sounds like you anticipate more fights being televised in Nigeria.
Television is the game. If you don't have television, you rely on people coming in, paying at the door, you lose your shirt, you know. So with television finally stepping in, talent's there, people will come out, sponsors will finally come on board, the fight game will be back with where it was in the 80s when we had Obisi and Wapa. I mean, those days we had some great fighters like Darazin, Abraham Tonika. These were guys that were really putting on great shows in Nigeria.
Nnamdi, let's look ahead to 2015 now. I know a heavyweight bout in the middle of January has caught your eye, and you're going to be packing your bags for Vegas.
Voice of America!
Tell our Voice of America fight fans about that.
Sonny, America's been waiting for a heavyweight champion of the world since the days of Mike Tyson. January 17, they call him the Bronze Bomber. His name is Deontay Wilder. He's going to take on the champion, Bermaine Stevens, January 17 for the WBC heavyweight title at MGM Grand Casino. The Bronze Bomber, 32 fights and 32 big knockouts. Bermaine Stevens, 24-1-1 with 21 knockouts. Sonny, in the fight game we call this a Picasso, which means it won't be pretty, somebody will go down. It won't go 12, man. So I must be ringside for this one. It's going to be real, real bomb dropping. And the big one, I mean, Sonny, the champion is 6'4". The challenger is 6'7". And both guys can pack a punch. So it's like dropping bomb, you know. So it's we call it a Picasso.
Nnamdi, would the winner take on Vladimir Klitschko?
Well, that's what we hope. But, you know, Vladimir Klitschko don't need these guys because they can fight. So Vladimir Klitschko will just stay in Germany, make his money, pull in 18,000 people, and he will run away from the winner of this fight. But, you know, hopefully HBO will put up the money. The winner of this fight will look really good, and they will force a fight because the winner of this fight will be the legitimate heavyweight champion of the world.
Nnamdi, you mentioned Floyd Mayweather as your fighter of the year for 2014. How likely is it that Floyd will finally face the Pac-Man, Manny Pacquiao, in 2015?
Sonny, interesting thing here is that both guys have said they want to fight May 2nd. And then what's stopping it? Well, we have lots of players here. I mean, we're talking big money. We're talking a fight that could bring in $300 million, you know. So what's holding up this fight? The players outside the ring, the promoters, the advisors. I mean, everybody wants a piece of this. Then on top of that, Manny Mayweather wants two-thirds of the money. Two-thirds of $300 million. That's no chicken change. Forgetting that the other man from the Philippines, Pac-Man, he's also a big draw. So if you want two-thirds of the money, that's just not going to happen. If you want maybe a 60-40 split, that's reasonable. So this fight is something that the whole world wants to see. We got a couple of Arab sheikhs coming in here to say we could have the money, 120 for Floyd Mayweather and this. But the real deal, it has to happen in America. And the fight fans want to see this fight. And both guys want it on May 2nd.
Nnamdi, the fight fans do want to see this fight. But in terms of where they're both at now in their careers, a little past their prime, What difference does that make at this point?
Well, this fight was will have been a great fight 5 years ago. These guys are just towards the end of their career. So Pac-Man got bombed by Marquez, and Mayweather is not what you call a knockout artist now. He will struggle for 12 rounds and but still win a decision. And people just feel, oh, he won't stand and fight. He's just running. So if this happened 5 years ago, maybe by now we'll have seen three fights out of these two guys. But right now, people are just getting tired. Everybody's looking greedy. And the fight fans just say, look, guys, if you guys don't fight, we're not going to pay to see you guys fight anybody.
Is there anybody else besides Pac-Man for Mayweather and Mayweather for Pac-Man, Namdi?
Well, rumor came out that Floyd Mayweather offered Miguel Cotto $40 million for Miguel Cotto, Floyd Mayweather 2, so that they can take away that May 2nd, the Cinco de Mayo date from Canelo. In the meantime, Alvarez Canelo from Mexico wants to fight Miguel Cotto, but Miguel Cotto is not really interested in fighting Canelo because there's a $40 million sitting there from Floyd Mayweather. The question becomes, will fight fans jump in and buy Floyd Mayweather, Miguel Cotto too? I don't think so, Sonny.
So right now, Namdi, that May 2nd date is kind of a sticking point.
Sticking point. Now, you don't have that much time, Sonny. If you're talking about a mega fight, you better start hitting the drums right now. You better start screaming right now because January is here. Before you know it, February, you need a solid 5-6 months to do a mega promotions for a big fight. So they better make a deal ASAP.
Namdi, let's give a shout out for Amir Khan from Britain of Pakistani origin.
Setting this whole event up for me, coming to Peshawar. A lot of people saying it's very dangerous, but, you know, I want to thank these people for doing that. Also, I want to thank the General Raheel Sharif for putting all this together for me, and also General Asim Bajwa.
He recently visited Peshawar, Pakistan, the scene of a deadly attack by the Taliban. More than 130 children were killed. Your thoughts on Khan going to that school, Namdi? What does it mean symbolically?
I'm really happy to see him returning to his roots because, well, this man is from Pakistan but grew up in England. The reason why Manny Pacquiao is huge today because he has this big, huge following in Asia. Khan heading back to Pakistan to his roots is a very good thing. But hey, he should stop waiting for Mayweather to fight him. He should go ahead and fight Ken Brooks in England and make it a big fight and then come out of it and he can talk about Mayweather. This cat has been sitting around waiting for Floyd Mayweather, hoping for the bigger lottery. I don't see that happening.
Namdi, one thing I see happening in 2015 is you firing more verbal jabs for our Voice of America listeners. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moweta. I'm VOA Sonny Young, wishing all our VOA listeners a happy new year in 2015. And that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a report by the World Meteorological Organization on the Earth's protective ozone layer. And next, a book published by a former South African soldier titled Back to Angola. But first, some music. Here is Zahara of South Africa with Umtualo.
I'm not afraid to die.
South Africa's Zahara with Omtuwalo.
Okay, really nice song, Yahias. The World Meteorological Organization reports the Earth's protective ozone layer is on track to recovery by the middle of the century. The agency says the so-called Montreal Protocol, which calls for the phase-out of ozone-depleting substances, is working. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization reports the rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere is the largest in 30 years. In addition, it notes two other important greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, also are continuing to grow. WMO Secretary General Michel Jarraud says this is not good news. He notes CO2 accounts for 80% of the 34% increase in the warming of the atmosphere from 1990 to 2013. He says the increasing concentration of CO2 is a worrying signal.
The other thing which is worrying is that CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a very long period, hundreds of years. So even if we could stop the emissions tomorrow, what has been injected in the atmosphere, a significant fraction would stay in the atmosphere for a very long period, hundreds to thousands of years.
Jarraud says about 25% of what is emitted by human activity is absorbed by the ocean. Another quarter by the biosphere, and the rest remains in the atmosphere. He warns past, present, and future CO2 emissions will have a cumulative impact on both global warming and ocean acidification. He tells VOA that time is not on our side. He warns the longer it takes to tackle this issue, the more challenging it will become.
Concentrations are reaching higher and higher value, and therefore it will require stronger and stronger action to avoid the climate changes to be so big that adaptation will be either more difficult, in some cases impossible, and in any case more expensive.
Jarraud says there's no doubt the climate is changing and weather is becoming more extreme due to human activities, such as the burning of fossil fuels. He says action is still possible, but it will take bold and courageous decisions on the part of nations. He says the world has the knowledge and the tools to keep temperature increases within 2 degrees centigrade. He says concerted international action must be taken for the sake of the planet and for that of future generations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A former South African soldier published a book earlier this year titled Back to Angola. It's about his return to a country he only knew in a state of war 25 years ago. VOA's Caroline Turner has more.
Paul Morris was 20 years old when he was sent to Angola as a soldier in the South African Army in 1987. They were allied with the rebels in the Angola Civil War, fighting against the Angolan army. 25 years later, he went back there, this time by choice and on a bike.
The essence of my decision to go back there was to see Angola in peacetime. My memories of Angola were just about war. The mere mention of the word Angola just meant war. It meant darkness, it meant fear, it meant nightmares, and I just wanted to change that. I wanted to have a balanced memory.
The 45-year-old pedaled for almost 1,500 kilometers from Cuito Cuna Valley in southeast Angola to his old unit's base in northern Namibia, entirely on his own. It took him 3 weeks riding for 8 to 10 hours a day and sleeping in villages or the bush.
The Angolan countryside in places is still littered with, in 2012 at least, it was still littered with military wreckage. Particularly on the road between Cuito Carnaval and Monongi, which used to be known as the Road of Death because of the government forces, convoys being ambushed, trying to reinforce Cuito.
Morris spent 3 months fighting in Angola in 1987, firing mortars that he knew were killing people.
It's a fact that he avoided thinking about for years until he realized that the memories were still haunting him and giving him nightmares. By returning to Angola and seeing the country in peacetime and communicating with villagers despite the language barrier, he was able to make peace with his own past.
The essence of my journey was to complete this healing journey, complete my own healing journey. And it worked, I think. I met these amazing people, former enemies. We had conversations that afterwards I realized were important for them, too, in terms of their own healing.
Morris translated that physically and emotionally exhausting trek into a book, Back to Angola. It's a chronicle of two journeys, a quarter of a century apart, that reconciles the young soldier with the grown man. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pledging to end the political infighting that threatened to paralyze the Somali government and distract officials from the important work of unifying the country under a federal framework, Omar Abdelrashid Ali Sharma Arke has been named Prime Minister of Somalia. Appointed by Parliament on December 24th, he becomes the East African nation's third premier in just over a year, following the removal of former Prime Minister Abdoulaye Sheikh Ahmed in November due to a no-confidence vote by Parliament. The earlier removal of Ahmed's predecessor, Abdi Farah Shirdon, after a political dispute with President Hassan Sheikh, disappointed the government's international supporters and distracted from efforts to combat the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Sharma Arke, who served previously as Prime Minister in the transitional federal government in 2009-2010, pledged on taking office to name an all-inclusive cabinet of ministers and address disputes through consultation and discussion. The United States welcomes the parliamentary confirmation of Prime Minister Sharma Arke. We look forward to the Prime Minister assuming office and to his prompt appointment of a capable council of ministers. We urge the President, Prime Minister, Parliament, and Council of Ministers to make progress toward realizing goals of critical importance to the nation, such as constitutional review, state formation, election preparations, development of military and police forces, and public financial management reforms. The United States remains committed to supporting the Somali government and people as they stabilize and rebuild their nation, and we look forward to strengthening our important partnership with Somalia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga.
Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.